This week on Best in Show, we talk to the Oscars bosses on the countdown to the 96th Academy Awards, and Slater Kinney reveal their Oscar faves. Yes, the Hot Rocks themselves. Hello, hello, and welcome to Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Livaccino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about award season. We meet contenders from this year's movies, interrogate insiders about the film ecosystem, and we look into that Letterboxd data, of course. But mostly, we do what we always do here at Letterboxd: celebrate cinema. And joining me to celebrate cinema are my Best in Show besties, our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
Kia ora.
And our Hollywood veteran and editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Dig me out of award season.
Oh my God.
Preach, so
preach.
We're almost there, Brian. At this point, we are just a couple of sleeps away from the 96th Annual Academy Awards, and very soon, we're actually going to be hearing from the CEO and president of the Academy, Bill Kramer and Janet Yang. And we have a very special Best in Show rock and roll treat, a chat about movies with Slater Kinney. But first, the news.
The news. I reckon we should have some Dune 2 reckons. And I say this because award season 2024 is almost over. Soon nominees will have their hands on the bad one. And Letterboxd members... Letterboxd members have delivered in its first week a stonking 4.6 rating for Dune Part 2. And so already, of course, it pains me to say this, but we're thinking about award season 2025. Sorry.
Sweep Part 2 incoming.
As of this week, and this might have changed by the time we edit this and put this out, Dune 2 is the sixth highest rated film of all time on Letterboxd. Obviously, recency bias. Also, you know, all the people in the movie. It is a Little Women reunion for Timothée and Florence. I can see they're already gunning for best sound at the 97th Oscars, because I woke up this morning to a very cool video doing the rounds of the sound team of Dune 2 showing how they did the butterfly helicopter thingy. Sorry, my Dune
ornithopter.
Oh, thank you. My Dune terminology is all broken, but I will correct that by actually seeing the movie tomorrow with Jack Moulton. So anyway, the sound effect, the wind wand, Mia, Brian, you've seen it.
Yes.
Bring on your reckons.
Ooh, yeah. I have had Dune Part 2 on the brain recently, especially because I actually just wrote up a big boxed office piece about Dune Part 2's impact on the Letterboxd community, full of wonderful reviews from all of the lucky members who have seen it. And hey, you can read it right now on our online magazine Journal. Wow, incredible. So I really enjoyed Dune Part 2. I enjoyed Dune Part 1, of course, but Dune Part 2 kind of blows it away. My friends and I can't stop saying stuff like, "I have secured the bloodline," and "desert power," and "may thy knife chip and shatter." And we're joking about how we should join the Bene Gesserit to further our careers. We're sandwalking around. Like, this is what immersive blockbuster cinema is supposed to be.
Mia, you also talked to Denis himself about the black and white, the monochrome of it all. I mean, come on.
It's true. I was being humble about it. I wasn't going to mention it, but thank you, Gemma, for plugging that for me. Yes. I did get to chat with Denis Villeneuve himself about, the black and white of the villain scenes of Giddy Prime. That's where the Harkonnens live. And it's really, really emphasized in this film in comparison to Part 1. And he had some wonderful answers about being inspired by Claire Denise Beautrevail and Ingmar Bergman. It was a wonderful interview. I'm very proud of it, if I do say so myself. Brian, get on in here. Share some Dune love.
What I love the most about it, I was kind of surprised by, and I read the books, but I thought it was, I read the first book.
The 896-page tome.
What I loved about it was actually like the melodrama toward the end. It felt like space William Wyler to me. I got some Eris vibes, which might sound a little odd, but it really set me out on such a high because of the interpersonal space melodrama. and the choice of how someone deals with emotional fallout by summoning a sandworm to ride it. I love that so much. I specifically am wording this so there's like no spoilers of anything that I'm talking about, but like the last 20 minutes was just like high quality melodrama in space. I love the whole ride, but that's what I love the most about it.
You deserve an award for managing to not spoil the end of Dune Part 2 with your little summary. Bravo, Brian. Bravo, Brian. So, it pains me to say this, but enough about those worms for now. Ouch. Oh, I wish we could talk about those worms forever, but this is an awards show podcast. We got to get back into awards season, the winding down awards season, in fact. So we will start with a quick little rundown of some of the Guild winners before diving into a small Oscar preview with what we're looking forward to and what the Academy CEO Bill Kramer and Academy President Janet Yang are looking forward to showing the world on Oscar Sunday this March 10th. But first, our Best in Show bestie, Jennifer Lame, won Best Edited Theatrical Film Drama for Oppenheimer at the American Cinema Editors Eddie Awards.
I just love the name. I love the name Eddie. Of that award. I like the Annies for the animations. I like the Eddies. Eddie's just such a cuter name than Oscar. I don't know why, but it's just such a silly thing to say. But
I love when the guilds can have some fun.
Yeah,
exactly. We should have some more fun with our awards. So, yes, the Eddies, and then Kevin Tent, armed with those dissolves, won Best Edited Theatrical Film Comedy for The Holdovers.
I can't believe you mentioned those dissolves. You know those dissolves give me pain, Mia. They just give me so much pain. I don't understand why
Brian
people are
loves
awarding
them, which evens it out. It evens it out. And the thing that brings us peace is we all love Jennifer Lame.
It's so true. It's so true.
Yes.
I do agree that Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, you know, should win the Best Edited Animated Feature Film, and indeed it did. But here's the thing, for documentary, a movie that has, according to your list, Mia, your master list, which we will mention a lot during this show, the 2023-2024 awards season master list, which is on our awards HQ. And this is a list that Mia has been updating for Letterboxd throughout, like since Sundance, beginning of last year, Sundance 2023. Lots and lots of films in there. A lot of films that have won like one audience award at a regional, you know, an important regional film festival. But basically there's just a lot of awards tracking in there. And one of the films, I was just looking at the list this morning, and one of the films that has a lot of awards but has not shown up at the Oscars is the Michael J. Fox documentary Still. Which is amazing. It's such a beautiful film. It's Michael J. Fox himself in sort of extreme close-up in his domestic environs. And then there is a dramatic reconstruction of him as a younger man filmed from behind. And then it sort of evolves into scenes from his movies. And it's just really clever. And I think it's a great win, a great Eddie win for Michael Hart, who won the documentary editing prize for that over other very impressive titles like 20 Days in Mariupol, American Symphony, the Joan Baez movie, and the Little Richard movie. There are a lot of Guild Awards, last minute Guild Awards this just past weekend. Also American Society of Cinematographers. Over to you, Brian, for that recap.
Hoyte Van Hoytema was the winner there for Oppenheimer, which he's deservedly winning from many, many, many branches. There is something on their winners list from the ASC that I did want to throw to you, Gemma, which is Warwick Thornton won the Spotlight Award for The New Boy. Can you shine a spotlight on that film for us? Because that might be new to a lot of listeners.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, that's so cool. I didn't know that. And it's exciting to talk about a film that we haven't talked about on Best in Show this season. Warwick Thornton is, of course, the Australian genius who wrote and directed Samson and Delilah, one of Australia's greatest films. He is his own cinematographer too, and has been a cinematographer for many other Australian movies. So this film, The New Boy, premiered at Cannes last year. My one-liner is Kate Blanchett as a nun who cosplays a drunk priest in the Australian outback. It is about much more than that, but there's a particularly excellent Kate Blanchett cosplaying a drunk priest scene. It premiered at Cannes last year, but I watched it the way every filmmaker intends their movie to ultimately be seen, on the airplane, on the way here to join you two, along with an Oppenheimer rewatch, since I'd only seen that in IMAX. And I don't know about you two, but there's something about watching a film on a plane that really, for me, concentrates the plot over the spectacle. And that's what I appreciated about my recent Oppenheimer airplane rewatch. Do you have vibes about watching movies on planes? Good, bad? Get something different from them?
Oh, my truth? My truth is I play my Nintendo Switch on planes and I don't watch movies. But before I had my Nintendo Switch, I did watch movies on planes, and I would only watch the 2012 film Les Miserables. And that is why I've seen that film maybe 15 times, is because that was the only movie I would watch. So there. That's all I can say.
I give films that I wasn't going to give a chance on the plane. And I do think it kind of enhances. I watched Noah on a plane. I was like, everyone is wrong. This movie is great. I watched Dungeons and Dragons.
The Russell Crowe Noah?
I loved it.
We're both watching Russell Crowe on the plane.
Who ever thought that the Russell Crowe Noah would get a mention on Best in Show?
I mean, we talked about the Pope's Exorcist once on Best in Show, so...
This is true. I guess, I mean, well, Russell Crowe, you know, I have to say this as a New Zealander, does bring us back to Australia. I would say that The New Boy is going to be released soon in the US. Its plot concerns a 9-year-old Aboriginal orphan who's taken in by two nuns in a very remote orphanage. The boy comes with strong spiritual connection to the land, which is a challenge for the very Catholic nuns. And that's the plot, but really the film is about colonization and Western religious domination over Indigenous knowledge. And I just think that Warwick, as a cinematographer, as well as a director, his strength is that he places people within country really well, so that the land effectively becomes a larger character and the people in it are almost insignificant. And the stories he tells are important in the moment, but you get the sense that the country will always outlive the people, and that all of the destructive colonialist projects are ultimately for naught. And I guess off the back of that, I'm really feeling the cognitive dissonance this week around the spectacle and glamour of the Oscars versus what else is going on in the world that is very, very difficult for Hollywood to talk about. And I'm really grateful to those folks like Mark Ruffalo who are talking about Gaza, has to be said. Warwick Thornton, one more thing about him, met him at TIFF. He is so much fun. He is a fun person in person. And I think that that brings us back to the awards circuit, because a lot of the success of the smaller films who don't have the millions of dollars for your consideration ads is all about those human interactions, or indeed those animal interactions in the case of Messi the dog from Anatomy of a Fall. I was wondering, Mia and Brian, if you had any favorite campaign strategies from this season.
Oh, since Brian is our Hollywood veteran, I'm going to let him take it away.
I think, speaking of limited budget, Godzilla Minus One, what they're doing, they only have one nomination. It's for Best Visual Effects, and it's maybe perhaps easier if you have one nomination to funnel all of your energy into that one. But it's unique because the director of Godzilla Minus One, Takashi Yamazaki, is also nominated. I mean, he's nominated within visual effects and his background is in visual effects. Everyone saw the viral video of the team reacting to their nomination. And I think that is like hanging back in a lot of people's minds. It's part of the reason why a lot of people are predicting it to win. It is great visual effects, particularly on the limited budget. But they also, like at the Oscar luncheon, they brought out like as many people from that video to be there as well, and kind of remind press, remind people seeing things from the luncheon that disseminate information from there that about that viral video. And I think that if they are successful on Oscar night, that will be something that people might try to replicate. I'm telling you, it's like groups and dogs is what give people the fuzzies. I think that Messi was brilliant, not just because like a beautiful, beautiful dog, but the dog performance, and it is a dog performance. It reminds it reminds how great and how tight Justine Triet's script is with her partner, Arthur Harari, because by having the dog around, it reminds us very specific plot point and also how well directed that dog was for that plot point. So it's not just a cute dog around, but it kind of reinforces the script.
Yeah.
And I think that was brilliant.
Oh, totally. And I think speaking of script, speaking of screenplay, Mia, I know that you have another favorite nominee that hasn't been talked about enough this season. This is your moment.
It's true. I am a major screenplay head. I love when all of the screenplays drop for the For Your Consideration campaigns, and we get to actually read these screenplays from these incredible writers every season. And I really want to bring up Poor Things. Okay, I know we've talked so much about Poor Things, okay? I know we have Poor Things fatigue, okay?
Oh, Poor Things. But Poor Things, which doesn't get enough love. I mean, no one talks about it at all.
Oh, no.
It has not just crossed the into the million watched club on Letterboxd as of this morning. Oh, that poor little independent film.
Poor Things. No, I know we've talked about it so much, but the thing that we haven't really been talking about that much is Tony McNamara's adapted screenplay. So he is brilliant. He also co-wrote the screenplay for Yorgos' last film, The Favorite. He's one of my favorite screenwriters working in the biz right now. And I am reading Alistair Gray's original Poor Things book at this moment. And it's so fascinating to see how Tony managed to adapt this very singular, unique story that's told from multiple perspectives into this film that's really from Bella's perspective. So in the book, the first half is from McCandle's perspective. That's Rami's character. The middle is from Duncan's perspective, which is Mark Ruffalo's character. And then the last is from Bella's. But instead, Tony and Yorgos and Emma and the whole team decided to make the whole thing about Bella. And I think that the film is just all the better for it. And on top of that, there are just some lines of dialogue in Poor Things that I just haven't gotten out of my head. Like when Christopher Abbott's character says, "On the discovery of your absence, I felt disemboweled. I have disemboweled men on the field of battle, and I always imagined a dull, hollow throbbing. And that is what it was like."
Oh, like, my gosh.
That's just brilliant. So I'm gunning for it.
I'm thinking about the dull, hollow throbbing of my head when I attempt to walk that carpet on Sunday. I can't.
I know, it's scary. It's so scary, but we're going to do amazing. So what are, okay, let's keep it positive. So what are we most looking forward to about being on that carpet?
Oh, I pitched up at Vidiot's last night for a screening of American Movie, and I asked a few people, we were chatting about the Oscars and what are you looking forward to? And basically everybody just said Martin Scorsese. You know, because it's a Martin Scorsese, and just seeing Marty walk is just such a pleasure. Marty walking into buildings, Marty walking along carpets, just like Martin Scorsese at all. And to that, I would add Thelma Schoonmaker, his editor, because, I just like seeing a legend in the flesh is, that would be cool. And Bobby and Barbie from Bobby Wine, The People's President, one of the nominated films, like the epic legends fighting for democracy in the face of insane opposition and violence. Like, bring it on. What about you?
Yes. Oh, well, while we're talking Barbie, I know it's a different Barbie. But if I don't talk to Ryan Gosling, my mom is going to get so mad at me. So that is who I'm looking forward to. But that's kind of a pipe dream. I'm not expecting Ryan Gosling. So I'm mostly excited to see Sammy Birch, the screenwriter of May December, and my girl, Celine Song of Past Lives once more. Those two filmmakers are just such huge, huge, huge inspirations to me. And seeing them carve out space for these complicated women's stories, you know, like evil women in the case of May December, and then more pure women like Nora from Past Lives, really just any women. Seeing them at the Oscars is just so, so affirming and dreamy.
Oh, dreamy. It is a dream. What are we most looking forward to about being like during this ceremony? Because big news, the Oscars now take place an hour earlier to a couple of things to accommodate the fact that the show will be 3.5 hours rather than its usual three, probably mostly because we're getting all of the musical performances, which is cool, and more on that very soon. And I'm, you know, all in favor of a longer cinema so we can celebrate more cinema, but it's also being pulled earlier because of broadcast reasons, so that it comes in under the primetime East Coast situation, like broadcasty stuff. But speaking of primetime, Brian, you've got a very specific thing you're looking forward to during the ceremony.
Yeah. Well, first, they've blocked out 3.5 hours. They're hoping to use three. So just so if that gave people a fright, a jump scare of the runtime, they're still aiming for three, but they've blocked out 3.5 hours just in case. But also with blocking out time, that's for commercial breaks, and they are $2 million a spot right now. I'm looking forward to the commercial breaks, not for the commercials, but because I get to be in the ceremony this year, which is a dream come true.
Yay!
Wait, oh yes, because you're one of the Kens in the I'm Just Kidding performance. We mm-hmm. we can announce
this. We're so excited to see you on that stage,
yeah,
Brian.
Exclusively, we can announce this on behalf of Best. No. We're joking, but
look very closely throughout the performance. You might just, if wherever there's a mustache, that's me. But no, I this is something that I've kind of always hoped for. I got a little teary-eyed when the invite hit my inbox. But being there during the commercial breaks, seeing who interacts with who, how the stage changes. I love seeing just like how the show is made. That is very fun for me to see as a producer. But the who interacts with who is a vital part of award shows. We talked about Netflix streaming the SAG Awards, and then YouTube was streaming the Indie Spirit Awards. So there are no breaks in those, and I think it robs the community feel during the ceremony. It happens before and after, but it's very, very nice to see the community actually interact with each other throhout this potentially 3.5 hour show. Mm. So that is what I'm looking forward to the most, is seeing who's running over to who in those commercial breaks.
I would say for those having Oscar watch parties at home, it's the same thing. We need that break. Okay, yes, we are kind of not watching your $2 million ad, but we sort of are, like by osmosis, but we need that break to discuss what's going on. And just mm-hmm. a reminder that if you are having a watch party at home, we do have downloadable ballots on the Awards HQ, which is so much fun. You know, Oppenheimer will probably take out everything, but, you know, who knows? You can still win your trophy at your watch party at home. Brian, thank you for mentioning community. That is exactly what I talked about with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences CEO Bill Kramer and President Janet Yang when I caught up with them to test the temperature of the Oscars team a few days out from the show.
Yes, it is time to go behind the curtain of the Academy to find out what's it all about for them, what some of their favorite Oscar moments from ceremonies past are, and importantly, what advice do they have for those walking the carpet for the first time?
Woohoo! As we talk, we are T-minus how many sleeps? Maybe six sleeps until the 96th Oscars.
That's a good way of putting it. Or maybe fewer.
Yeah,
we
maybe
don't know.
Fewer. I mean, is anybody maybe sleeping?
You were assuming we're sleeping. I love that.
Yeah. I realized I made my first mistake right then. I wish for you some moments of naps this week. But seriously, at sort of 6 days out, where are you at in your heads and in your relationships with each other, your staff, the whole shebang? What's the vibe?
It's not I'm saying this is not just a line, but we're in good shape, right? Where I feel surprisingly relaxed. Bill and I are really aligned. The show producers are amazing. Every day we just hear good news. Like, we have these presenters and we're doing this. And so I'm personally so excited, and I think the audience will be very excited about the show as well.
I second all of that. It's been a very smooth year. We have incredible producers. Gemma, you've seen announcements on our presenters and our performers, so that's out in the world. The show is looking fantastic. we've both been at the Dolby looking at the set, and rehearsals are starting. It's going to be a great year. And the team, as always, is working hard, but there's a great collaborative sense of purpose and working towards this huge goal that the film industry needs and loves, and the film world needs and loves. So we feel a great responsibility in producing the show.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine you feel that every year, but it's particularly pertinent in the, I was going to say in the wake of the pandemic, but you know, still it rolls on, and still it impacts theatrical turnouts, even in a Barbenheimer year. And so I guess I do have some thoughts about what the Oscars, beyond the pomp and ceremony, contribute to audience engagement in that way, to global confirming of the power of the big screen.
If we've learned anything in these couple of years in our positions, it's that the brand is so strong. It's something that has so much power and a unifying force, because the love of storytelling, the love of cinema spreads far and wide in every corner of the planet. And we feel so privileged that we're able to uphold that brand and keep iterating so it remains relevant to younger generations. And we keep the excitement, and also the community building around cinema has been so powerful this year, even more so than in past years. The social media presence has been very strong, and there's just a lot of, I guess, what we call buzz. And that's very exciting.
Agree with everything you just said, Janet, as we always do. We always seem to agree. You actually, your earlier question about our relationship, stronger than ever. But you know, I'm so lucky that I became CEO and Janet became president, and we've been able to work together for the last 2 years in harmony, and it's been such a treat and an honor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, wanted to reference that earlier question, but you know, I agree with everything that Janet just said. The Oscars are a great global unifier, harmonizer for the film industry, the global film industry. And as you said, we've had an interesting couple of years with the pandemic and the strikes. People are engaging with films in a different way. Many more people are watching films at home. But that means our art form is almost more relevant than ever. More movies are being made and watched than ever before around the world. So we are at the center of that conversation. And it's a great, again, responsibility and honor that the Oscars can bring the film community together from around the world and global film lovers together.
Bill, you mentioned announcements, presenter announcements, and so on and so forth. And I obviously there were great calls for will Ryan Gosling perform I'm Just Ken at the Oscars, and you finally confirmed it. I don't know what was involved in making that happen, but obviously we're quite excited. I'm also really thrilled that the Wajaje Choir will be on the stage, and so I guess I'd love to hear you talk a bit to that. That expanse of films and creatives that we have this year as a result of the films that were made this year.
Yeah, we're seeing an incredibly diverse slate of nominees and films this year, which is extremely exciting. You have big box office powerhouses, Barbie, Oppenheimer. You have more intimate films, Past Lives being one of them. We loved Past Lives. And a lot of global cinema, Anatomy of the Fall, The Zone of Interest. It's a very diverse year across the board. And I think that speaks to how people are engaging with films these days around the world. So that's really exciting. And as our membership becomes more diverse and global, I think you will see at the Oscars a more diverse slate, a more global slate of nominees, and in this case, performers. And we are so excited to have Ryan performing and all of our performers this year, John, Becky G, and obviously from Killers, it's going to be such a beautiful performance. And we are going to be thrilled and entertained, I think, with all of these moments on the show. It's going to be powerful.
Mm. Not to mention Billie Eilish, she'll be there. And, you know, we have just amazing song numbers. I won't jump ahead, but one of my best moments is a song from a past year, and we'll get to that later, but I'm reminded of the excitement.
No, let's go there. I was going to say, you know, it's well, first of all, I have a very silly question, and that is because, you know, I obviously, you can tell from my accent, I'm not of Hollywood. Last year in the press room, Mia Levachino and myself, you were kind enough to accredit us to be in the room, which was incredibly, I have to say, an incredible moment for a girl from the suburbs of Auckland, New Zealand, Tamaki Makaurau Aotearoa, who grew up watching the Oscars and never dreamed that I would be in any way in that realm. And then this year, amazingly, this is so cool, Letterboxd will be on the carpet as well. Mia will be there with the Letterboxd mic next to your team. And then walking in, do you have any advice for me or any of the nominees listening for whom it is their first Oscars for walking that carpet for the first time? I've read the extensive instructions of what to do and what not to do. I've read that it takes at least 30 minutes to walk that carpet. Like introverts unite. That's got to be terrifying. What's your advice for a good carpet walk?
First of all, I want to say something. What you said about you're not of Hollywood, if you look at my face, you can tell I'm also not of Hollywood. And it is such a thrill. And that's just another indication of the changing world and industry and the Academy. And I pinch myself every day because I can't believe I get to do what I'm doing. But as far as walking the carpet, I would say make sure your dress is not so long that you're going to step on it. I have this constant fear. Remember Jennifer Lawrence once here going up on stage trip, these long dresses and trails and capes and ties, they're very easy. Or you're stepping on somebody else's dress or somebody's stepping on your dress. That's one advice. And then just enjoy it. Relax, smile for the cameras and enjoy. Enjoy the walk.
I won't speak to the dress comment.
Oh, come on, Bill. One day.
No. I mean, it's wear what makes you feel great and comfortable. I think a lot of rules about dressing for the show have changed, which is fantastic. It's a once in a lifetime moment. Enjoy it. Savor it. You should be there. We should all be there. And it's great fun. It's really fun.
On the fashion front, if I may add, one thing that many of us have been discussing is that men are giving a run for their money, giving women a run for their money too. The fashion on men has changed drastically, and it's so much fun to look at their costumes as well as women's.
Oh, so deeply. I mean, Coleman Domingo, he's the one I think we've all had our eye on all season.
The pink.
Well, okay. Well, then speaking also of we should be, I love that comment. We should be there. We should all be there. That's everything, Janet. And I think just keep saying it. And speaking of that, let's move into favorite Oscar memories, because of course, again, for me as a New Zealander, it's got to be Anna Paquin using up minutes, I don't know, what felt like hours of valuable advertising screen time, just gasping as she stood on that stage receiving her supporting actress Oscar for The Piano. And then that beautiful New Zealand accented, "I'd like to thank Jane." It's such a great memory for me and among any of the performances from years past. What are yours?
I have a few, Janet, but I wonder if we have some overlaps. I
was so curious to hear yours. I can't wait.
So you haven't compared notes? I love this. You talk every day, but
not talk about it. Okay. No, not on this. Not about this.
Parasite winning in 2020. But look, we all reference that moment. We're very close with Mickey Lee, one of the producers. So that was a great personal moment for all of us. But I think it signaled a great change within the Academy, an international film winning Best Picture. That was huge and a great moment of joy. I also think about Natalie Portman winning for Black Swan. It felt like a real breakthrough for her. She's so incredibly talented. You saw it this year with May December, not only as an actress, but as a producer. So I personally love that moment. Halle Berry's Best Actress win. I could watch that speech a million times and not cry. It's so emotional, so beautiful. We have it prominently featured in our Oscars gallery at the Academy Museum, and people linger and weep and are so moved by that moment. And, you know, another big moment for me was when Roma won Best Foreign Language Film. That was huge for Mexico, and it was great for Cuarón. And our Latinx viewership is massive. And I think a really exciting moment for international cinema. And again, another moment where, even though it was for the then called foreign language film category, it signaled a change in how our Academy members were viewing movies. It was very exciting.
Those are good ones. We overlapped on one, which is the Parasite moment. I was sitting a couple of rows behind director Bong Joon-ho, and I literally thought I screamed my head off. I just couldn't believe it. And it was so, on the one hand, deserving but unexpected, having it be the first non-English language movie. Here are a couple of others in no particular order. Seeing Tatum O'Neill win an Oscar and walking up on stage and in her tuxedo was so, because again, I was not of Hollywood. I had nothing to do with Hollywood at that. I can't remember what year that was exactly. 74. Yeah. I was a kid. I couldn't believe that someone that was sort of close to my age was actually standing up there holding an Oscar. It was just such a moment. And it made me realize I knew nothing about Hollywood and how it really, I was like, can they even do this? Can they give someone under 18 an Oscar? Is there some rule about that? So that was one. Another was Roberto Benigni when he won.
Yeah.
And when he was climbing on the backs of the seats, I just was in hysterics. I thought it was with his sort of rubbery body floating around. I thought that was brilliant. And then obviously Parasite. And then just from last year, the Natu performance in RRR.
We were
in rehearsals. And when I saw them come out, the first part was that they were sort of, shoving Jimmy off stage. And at first of all, I couldn't even believe how they mostly dance on one foot. And they just, the strength that it takes. And I just thought that was hilarious. And I love that, especially for the people of India.
Absolutely. I just remembered another favorite moment. Obviously, when Brett McKenzie won Best Original Song for Man or Muppet. And it does make me think about I'm Just Ken this year. And I mean, among so many brilliant nominated songs, it just makes me happy as a musical comedy fan that musical comedy songs can make it all the way to the Oscars. And I felt a little bit robbed of not getting to see Brett and Kermit perform at the Oscars that year. So I'm just really happy on behalf of the audience that we are going to get Ryan. It's a great move. It's a great move. Will Allen be there? It's a question I've been asked to ask on behalf of some Letterboxd team members. All the Kens will be there. Will Allen be at the Oscars?
Allen, I thought you.
I thought you said Ellen.
No. I'm so sorry. Which Allen? Sorry, it's my accent. Oh my god!
we will not give away anything about the performance or the attendees, but it is going to be a spectacular performance. And I think going back to something you're sort of referencing, the Oscars, in addition to being the ultimate celebration of cinema across disciplines, we capture a lot of great pop culture moments. And you've referenced a few. I think Ken is another great pop culture moment. Barbie is a great pop culture moment. Think of moments like Madonna arriving with Michael Jackson. I mean, there are certain things that, you know, happen at the Academy Awards that do not happen elsewhere. And so I think in addition to the great amount of honoring that we do in celebrating the many disciplines of movie making, we also are a great sort of barometer of pop culture. And it's something that no other award show can capture in this way.
Mm. We also have to keep a few secrets so you'll tune in. We can't give everything away.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm hoping for the Last Repair Shop Orchestra. I have to say, commend you once again on the Oscars week at the Academy Museum. I went to the documentary shorts program yesterday. I am so glad I saw those films in that theater instead of on Disney Plus, on Netflix, where a lot of them are. What an extraordinary lineup of short docs, and to have their makers introduce them. And I don't know if you were there, but they were talking about the most important thing. You've vaguely mentioned this, but the most important thing about this week, while everybody else is kind of going, oh, movie stars, you know, the Oscars, what's the big deal? Like that you hear these filmmakers yesterday talking about community, the sense mm-hmm. of community, of being the lucky ones, really, who, and talented ones who have been brought together mm-hmm. from across mm-hmm. the world to be in a room together, not imagining that that would ever happen when they set out to make these exquisite stories, I have to say, you know, from book banning to Taiwan's unique geopolitical role at the moment, through to making sure that the school children of LA who can't afford them have musical instruments, and that when they're broken, they're fixed. I mean, it was an incredible lineup, and that's just one category. So just to bring it all back to the movies, I wanted to congratulate you on that.
Yeah.
Well, it does make me so proud that we are able to highlight short documentary films, feature documentary films, international films, live action shorts, that each gets equal treatment. And they are extraordinary. I thought this year of movies, not just the Best Picture nominees and not just the ones that the public knows more about, but the docs, as you say, the short docs, the feature docs, the international, are so incredible. And the fact that we're able to provide this platform for these films that would otherwise probably not get the same recognition is something that is truly gratifying. Mm. Each story is so powerful. Like I watched them. I just thought this, you know, each one is so very powerful.
I mean, we're talking about Ken, but let's all agree that the pop culture moment this year is Nai Nai and Waipor.
Well, Nai Nai and Waipor were actually at the nominees luncheon. I met them and I speak Chinese, and they were so stunned that I could talk to them in Chinese. It just was a beautiful moment. Yeah.
Can I circle back to one quick thing you said? I know we're probably running out of time, but you mentioned the word community, and I just don't want to move past that without saying that is so core to who we are as an academy. We build community among our members across disciplines. You saw it at the museum for some of the nominee programs. The Academy Museum is an amazing place to build community among film lovers from around the world who are coming to visit in person and engaging with our digital platforms. But the Academy has the unique power to build community among not just the filmmaking industry and our Academy members, but film lovers and arts and culture patrons around the world. That is so core to who we are as an organization. So I love that was a takeaway for you.
And that's what Letterboxd exists to do as well. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
Very much so.
And we all work within community.
Yeah. And you've done a great job. I'm scared to go on Letterboxd, I have to confess, because I don't feel like I can't reveal. We have to not show any favoritism. So I'm like, I can't say anything, especially during voting season. I heard you can be anonymous. So that's a possibility too.
You can completely be anonymous. You can put up a weird avatar. You can change your name. Nobody needs to know that it's Janet from the Academy who just watched Easy A for the 47th time. Yeah. It's fine.
We're big Emma fans. So maybe we are watching Easy A over and over again. You never know.
Community is the most important thing. And hey, our own community holds its own Letterboxd Oscars.
It's true. Run by Letterboxd member Darren Carver-Balsiger, every year these community awards are where members vote for the best films of 2023 using rules similar to the real Oscars, but with some different outcomes, which is a lot of fun. You can see all the results of the Letterboxd Oscars at the link in our awards HQ right now. The 96th Oscars, of course, kick off on Sunday, March 10th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. They are live on ABC in the US. And again, you can jump on our awards HQ to to grab those printable ballots and more info about where else the Oscars are streaming and screening in other parts of the world.
It has been a busy, busy week for us as we pick up our credentials, dry clean our dresses, hem those tuxedos, and generally get ready for Letterboxd's first appearance on the Oscars red carpet. So squeezing in any historic award-winning watches has been a little bit tricky, but we have done our best. I was very lucky, and I got to see my favorite plane movie, Les Miserables, in a Dolby theater. They re-released Les Mis for 1 week in Dolby Cinemas, thank God. And this was my first time seeing it on the big screen. I'm not kidding. It was my first time seeing Les Mis in a theater. So this was probably my 15th watch, first in a theater. And you know what? Anne Hathaway deserved Best Supporting Actress for her role as Fantine. She dreamed that dream. Yes. Gemma, what did you watch?
Oh, my friends, forgive me that I live and you are gone. Sorry. I was just having a...
My friends forgive me.
I was thinking about, you know, the end of the Oscars and the empty chairs at empty tables.
And empty tables.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. No, it was, for me, it was, got home to the Airbnb, turned on TCM channel like every American knows how to do. And George Stevens's Giant was just beginning. So I sat there for
What? 3 hours and 20 minutes. I've done the same thing, Gemma.
Oh, yeah. Watching the Oscar for Best Director in 1957 winner, American epic and inspiration for Killers of the Flower Moon. And yeah, it was epic. And Elizabeth Taylor, woof. She's never been better. It's one of those movies where you kind of avoid it because you see James Dean on the poster and you're like, oh, that's a 3 hour plus men's movie about men doing men things in America. And then you watch it and you go, ah, yeah, but this is also a women's movie. This is also about the strength and I can't moral certitude of women in these ghastly, unforgiving male oil welling environments. Yeah.
Women.
Yeah. Women.
Speaking of woof, I did a little Marissa Tomei watching after watching Upgraded, where she, after watching Upgraded, where she basically plays Edna Mode from The Incredibles, which is as incredible as that sounds. I was like, I need to watch My Cousin Vinny again.
Yes.
And it's one of the most fun Best Supporting Act. It's one of the most fun acting awards the Oscars have ever given, which is why a lot of people think it was a mistake, but it is not a mistake. She owns that movie. They should name wrenches
not
after her for, yeah, not a mistake at all. My Cousin Vinny, she blends in to the Golden Winners, in my opinion. It's so much fun.
Love it, love it, love it.
Enough about what we watched. We have a very special treat to finish off the show. Gemma, we overlap in so much of like the indie rock space before we ever came together in Letterboxd. I knew you were the person to send to Sleater-Kinney at their rehearsal studio just before their new tour kicked off to talk their four favorite films. But also, you asked about their favorite Oscar movies.
I did. They did. It was, thank you, Brian. What a moment. I mean, you know, I'm here for the Oscars. I didn't quite expect that I would be sent off to a suburban rehearsal studio to talk to a band that I first started playing on the radio when their first album came out. So that was pretty frickin' cool. But I knew as we were talking about cinema that I also had a job to do, not just for myself as a fan, but for Letterboxd members and Carol stans everywhere. I knew I had to ask Carrie Brownstein for some memories of her brief appearance in Todd Haynes' Queer Palm winning film.
I'm in that movie for 10 seconds, maybe five, but it was really fun to be on set. I'm a big fan of Todd Haynes, big fan of Rooney Mara, big fan of Cate Blanchett, who I never met, but it was just fun to go to Cincinnati and make a movie for 48 hours and then be in 5 seconds of it. But just to be adjacent to the film is cool. It's a beautiful film. It's a classic. And I also loved May December by Todd Haynes. I thought it was, it's just walks such a fine line. Like only Todd Haynes could take something, such a thorny subject, make it both camp and very touching and sort of use camp to expose something truthful about a moment, you know, about a situation, about a relationship. I think he is very adept at using camp as a language to, as to be incisive about something and not frivolous. He sort of uses camp in the best way, which is actually to use spectacle to get to the heart of something.
What about you, Corinne? What have you enjoyed from this award season's films?
So I think in terms of talking about other movies that we've watched this year, Past Lives by Celine Song was one of my favorites. It's an incredibly beautiful movie. It's cinema that makes no apologies for being cinema. It's slow. It's very thoughtful. And it very much just dives into the world that we're in of the character at the time, whether it's Korea or the United States. And I love that about it, that it gives us that kind of full experience of where the character is at and what they're going through. And I thought that her take on, you know, really the implications of how, especially our lives as women, change and the expectations and also the ability to chart a very different course, you know, to really focus on career as, you know, the main focus of your life. And what that means is it's incredibly important, and it is in some ways heartbreaking because it letting go of another expectation you might have had for yourself and what your life was going to be based around. It's complicated. And I love that she gave us the ability to think about that and to experience it and to feel it as strongly as we do in that movie. So I thought it was great.
I loved Anatomy of a Fall. I also loved Past Lives, but Anatomy of a Fall, I think, is a wonderful, I mean, it's, I love these kind of horror movies that are kind of slow horror, you know, just like the encroaching horror of our lives, of disintegration of a relationship, of, you know, leaving things unanswered and uncertain, I think is really a metaphor for so much of life and for the sort of existential crisis that we always find ourselves in. But again, this movie, it's just, I like that it operates in two languages, that you have this protagonist who is trying to defend herself, both in her native language and in French, which is where she is in the story. And to me, that's a wonderful analogy for just how we are in the world. There is always misunderstanding and misconception about who we are and what we mean. And I think that's also sort of an analogy for cinema, is like trying to convey something using one visual vernacular and not really being able to know for sure how people are, you know, what they're gleaning from it. So it's just this multi-layered, beautiful film, and also devastating about couplehood and two artists and jealousy and rage and, yeah, and truths and untruths. It's a masterful film.
Also, when The Sun's Minder came on screen, were you like,
yeah,
that's Jenny Beth from Savages.
Is that Jenny Beth?
Is that Jenny Beth? And I was like on my phone watching, going like, oh my God, she's incredible.
She's great in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing it's hard to reckon what she's like on stage with this, you know, very understated character. Yeah. Great acting. Great film. Sandra Hüller. I mean, what a year. Zone of Interest. Anatomy of a Fall. It's been a great year for cinema.
Yes, it has been a great year for cinema. And my last recent pick is The Holdovers by Alexander Payne. I absolutely loved that movie so much. It's another movie I feel like is just, it really takes its time to tell the story in an emotional way that gives us the ability to really feel everything the characters are going through. You know, I think Paul Giamatti is amazing in it. And you have so many feelings about his character. He's, you know, he's kind of a jerk to the kids at times. And then, you know, as the movie goes on, you learn more about him. You become more empathetic to him. Is it Dominic Sessa, that the young actor that's in it is incredible? You know, it's his first film role, and it just, the chemistry between the two of them and what they, how their characters build in the film is amazing. And please remind me of the actress's name.
Joy Devine Randolph.
She's incredible as the worker in the school. Her story, I feel like, is really given the full, you're really fully able to hear her story and the way that the movie unfolds. And it's incredibly moving. And her performance, I hope she wins the Oscar. I think she absolutely deserves it.
She will. Yeah. By the time this airs, she may win as a airing. We don't know, but she's probably going to be an Oscar winner. Great year for movies. And we will be watching them all on our tour and so much more.
Are there any films or cinema moments that influenced or maybe made their way into the songs on your new album, Little Rope?
I don't think on the new album so much, but things that have inspired us, like Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains is a film that, you know, it's young Laura Dern, young Diane Lane, amazing guest appearances by members of The Clash. That movie really influenced us. It's about these two girls who form a band. It's filmed in Vancouver, also Pacific Northwest connection. That's very, what else?
The Hot Rock.
Oh, The Hot Rock. We have an album named after the film with Robert Redford called The Hot Rock, about a jewel thief. That album, this is all apropos, that album is turning 25 this year. So really, we're in our year of cinema as Sleater-Kinney.
Mm-hmm. We're playing a lot of songs off of The Hot Rock, actually, because of that. And it's really fun to visit that and feel those influences and yeah.
Make it part of the tour. So if you like Robert Redford, come to our shows, come to our tour. He will not be there, but we will be playing songs off an album that was based on a film he was in. So it's a very couple degrees of separation.
Sleater-Kinney are on tour right now in the U.S. through April 5th, ending in my hometown of Portland, Oregon.
Yes, that's where they're based. You get to claim them. But Sleater-Kinney, that's an intersection in Olympia, Washington, which is where they started, which is like my journey. That's where I started before I came down to Hollywood.
Oh, well.
The Pacific Northwest to Hollywood pipeline is beautiful.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest to Hollywood to New Zealand pipeline is even more beautiful. I'm off to New Zealand after the Oscars. And so are Sleater-Kinney. They take a month off after their US dates, and then, which is very award season-like, and then they hit Auckland, New Zealand in mid-May, and Australia. Then they're off to Europe, and our newsletter editor, George Fenix, home base in London in August. It sort of feels like they're doing a best in show tour of the world, all in support of their new album, Little Rope, which is spectacular.
Speaking of George, we had to get a little speaking of thrown in there. He will be with us next week for the Best in Show grand finale with all the Oscars action and our own Brad Mose Awards, named after our wonderful little cats. If you have any obscure award suggestions, please send those right in to podcast@letterboxd.com. Thanks for listening to Best in Show. Please follow us on our awards HQ on Letterboxd using the link in our episode notes.
Thanks to our crew, Slim for the edit, Sophie for production, Trent Walton for the music, George Fenwick for newslettering, Danny Haas for the art, Brian and Mia for being the best besties ever, and the entire Letterboxd content team for all the extra good stuff.
And thank you for listening. Best in Show is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.